Welcome to this podcast by the Research Institute of Industrial Economics in Stockholm, Sweden. My name is Elisabeth Precht, and with me here in the studio is Hernando de Soto, founder of the Institute for Liberty and Democracy, a renowned think tank in Lima, Peru. In 1999, Time magazine chose Mr. de Soto as one of the five leading Latin American innovators of the century. And in his speech opening the 2004 World Economic Forum at Davos, former US President Bill Clinton described Mr. de Soto as the world's most important living economist. The list is long of positive statements about Hernando de Soto and his work. Mr. de Soto, welcome to Stockholm and Sweden.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Yesterday here in Stockholm, you received the Global Award for Entrepreneurship Research, the leading international award in entrepreneurship research with a prize sum of 100,000 euro. What was your first thought when you got the message that you had received this award, and what will you do with the money?
Well, first of all, I was delighted to be honored by people from the academic sector. That's not where I'm from. I write once in a while to get a message across. I try to do that through different venues. Each one serves a different purpose, but I am not accustomed really to get it from academic circles, though a lot of professors have to do with the prizes I get, so I guess I'm doing all right. What will I do with the money? That's a very good question. I don't know yet because I'm at a threshold moment in my life in which I'm thinking of entering into other fields. Actually, I've entered into many other fields, and I will see, since I'm an entrepreneur of sorts, what works out in the next 3 months, and that's where I'll plow the money in.
I hope you will keep us posted.
I will. The thing, to tell the truth, is one of the things that has come across is the idea of using new systems of information technology like distributed ledger systems, blockchain, as a way to organize information, as a way to contact people. I intend not to use it the traditional way, but another way. I'm working on that. If my proposals work out, the money probably will go mostly in that direction. If it doesn't, I'll find a new direction.
Yes. Okay. So, looking a bit into where you come from, so to say, your father was a Peruvian diplomat.
Yes, he was.
He went into exile with you and your mother and your brother in Switzerland.
Yes.
So how was it at that time to grow up in Switzerland and have your roots in Peru, the very rich and the very poor?
Well, at that time we didn't. My brother and I were somewhere in the course of about 5 years old. And so the idea that we were rich or poor or doing well didn't hit us so much. What hit us much more was the attitude of our parents. Our parents were very unhappy. They wished they were back home or in the diplomatic career. So that's what we felt. We Europeanized very quickly. Afterwards, many 20, 30 years later, we had to de-Europeanize and re-Latin Americanize. But we lived in two cultures, the culture of my parents, which was at home, which was in Spanish, it was Latin America, and everybody missed Latin America. And so they made us miss Latin America, though we hadn't really lived there very much. And my mother would read letters at lunchtime, the ones that she got from Peru, and she'd tell us what was happening, and we would see photographs. And so we were reminded, just in case we would forget, that we were Peruvians. They were very Latin Americanist. But we grew in both cultures, and most of my friends are actually the friends of school and university, and they're Europeans. Mm.
This, with living in two cultures, has it made you more thinking out of the box, you believe? Or has it this with being having one leg in one culture and one leg in another culture?
I wouldn't know if that is the source of any attribute of innovative thinking. I suppose it has helped. Certainly I take what I learned from Europe and the other way around, and it's helpful, but I'm not too sure that it helps. Rather, the two cultures in some aspects are confusing.
Okay.
Because I went to school, for example, in Geneva, called the International School of Geneva, and we were 72 nationalities, exiles, sons of, from movie actors to politicians who didn't have time for their children. And so we formed a culture of our own. And we have a magazine that circulates among us, and it's called Roots. And the question is, how much has it affected our lives as we've gone back home, and many of us haven't fully adapted. And because we just know that the world is bigger than home. And so one of the recommendations is stop thinking of yourself as a plant. Plants have roots, we don't. That's okay. Where we are today.
That's where you are, yes. You were, as you said, mostly educated in Europe and had a successful career here. I believe you ran the, you said yesterday at the prize ceremony, the largest engineering consulting company in Switzerland?
Yes, I did.
Yes.
It was Universal Engineering. It belonged to the Schweizerische Bankverein.
Okay.
And it was the largest consulting engineering company
yes.
in Switzerland.
Yeah. So, and still, you decided end of the 70s to move back to Peru. Why?
Well, because I always wanted to. Because this was what my parents had injected in me. And it's just simply that I started getting one good job after another. Before being the head of the consulting engineering firm, I was the head of an international organization at the age of 27.
Oh, wow.
Called the International Copper Association Country. And it was just, it was ridiculous, really, because you shouldn't have a responsibility so young. But, you know, those were times in which they were very revolutionary and there were not many people around with languages and with some kind of an education. But my intention had always been to try and go back to Peru, see if it actually worked. And so I went back simply as a matter of course. It was something I had to do, and it worked. It took time. It wasn't so easy, but it worked. And then here I am, very Peruvian. Mm.
So you started out as an entrepreneur in Peru as well.
In Peru, I actually did two things. This is one of the good things about coming from a developing country. You can do two, three, four things at the same time. So I was one, I had this business with associates in mining, and I was also a governor of the Central Reserve Bank.
Okay. And then in 1980, you started the think tank, Institute for Liberty and Democracy.
I started it with some friends. I dedicated about an hour a day to it. It had different functionaries. It's only about 1984 that I decided to get in it fully, because the time had come. It became good to do it. It was well-funded. And I got more interested in that than in mining, quite frankly.
Mm. You and your colleagues at ILD work with hands-on concerns, I would say, more than a lot of think tanks do. And you work with reforms, and you've worked with a lot of statesmen in regards to reform. Can you tell us a bit, how did that come about?
That's interesting to reflect upon. Basically, at the beginning, our idea was to produce change. I thought I had a view on what was wrong, because I had a way of asking the extra-legal economy, which is the majority of Peruvians that worked outside, why were they were outside when they obviously wanted to be inside? When Peruvians migrate, like Mexicans, like Chinese, like Arabs to the United States or Europe, they want to be inside. So why don't they want to be inside back home? So I found that that was a good place to go and fetch answers. And you found out from them that it took them 900 days to do something, 500 days, that life was not easy if you were originally poor or you were of a, shall we say, inferior caste or social era. So that was where we were going. Then after a while, we started seeing solutions. We started measuring obstacles, seeing solutions, and then we started proposing legislation. Then the two presidents that we had in Peru, 1980 to 85, and then 85 to 90, started accepting our proposals. And all of a sudden, we started seeing our legislation go through. And we had a good strategy for passing it through, including we had in the Institute very good journalists that had anchor programs on television, and politicians wanted to go onto the programs. So we started getting the legislation through. Not only it was good legislation, it was debated. We insisted always on previous discussion. We created an organization called Defender of the People, the purpose of which was to receive all criticism so that everything we passed had been fully debated and won. Then we started seeing that nothing happened. And we started saying, why is nothing happening? And then we started thinking about it. I traveled to different countries and I said, it isn't happening because a series of institutions are missing that could make it happen. For example, we want people to start having certain economic rights. There is no office that takes care of that in Peru. Let's form it.
What kind of rights, for example?
Rights like, for example, the right to do business. Hmm. So what we found is a system for finding out where the blockages were. The system was so successful that the World Bank spent 6,000 human hours, in our offices and created doing business on the basis of that.
That they still do today.
Which they still do today. It's the flagship program of the World Bank. Mm. So we started discovering how to do that, how to do titling quickly, how to do it efficiently. And then we started running the offices of the Defender of the People, the titling office, the doing business office. And then afterwards, we actually ran part of the war against the terrorist system. So we started becoming an action tank. Mm. And we found it very complementary to the world of research, because you got the research directly. I think Ronald Coase at one time, who was advised, I asked, the Nobel Prize winner, had said, he got his Nobel Prize he was in Tunisia. And he said, you know, what he admired the most when he was in Tunisia, he said, these Peruvians. So I'm very proud of saying this. It's self-aggrandizement, but it was very good because he said, many what happens is that many economists, when asked what they think about horses, they would go to their desk and say, now, what would I do if I were a horse? Well, these Peruvians go out and look at a horse. So the result is we do research, but we do the research to get the data and act upon it. And probably we need more reflection, but that's the way we research.
Yes. Action tank, that's a new word. So you talk about dead capital, and that is the capital that cannot be used, even though people own things. So how much dead capital is there?
Oh, according to Aristotle, it's infinite, because he said one phrase which I had heard somebody talk about, and then I actually had to hire a philosopher to find it for me. That's a very short phrase. He said, or he wrote, the potential of anything is bigger than the thing itself. And so the general idea then I found out is this, that, you know, you can combine things, and when you combine things, you get surplus value. So from my point of view, when I read Marx, I said there seems to be two sources. You can create surplus value, or shall we say in Latin, value ex nihilo, from nowhere, by combining things. A piece of bread, you put a ham on it, it's a sandwich, it's worth slightly more, and you keep on adding until it gets very complex, like a computer, then you create it much more value. That is one thing. And the other part, of course, is exploitation. You can take someone and pay them very badly and make the difference yourself. So how much dead capital there is, I would suppose that we've got many times more dead capital. If dead capital is seen as being the result of surplus value. Now, the thing is that surplus value, which is additional value, is an abstract concept. So how do you capture the addition?
Yes.
And then to me, that's when property rights came in. I never thought of property rights first. The thing is, if I have to look for where Bill Gates has got all the money he earned by putting microchips together with a series of mechanisms to create additional value. It's on a piece of paper. That's where he captures it. Mm. When he has an idea and he has to download it, he catches it on a piece of paper. Well, in my times, it was a piece of paper. Now you can catch it on a blip. So the general idea is that there's an infinite amount, how far we shall see. But the fact is, if we keep on combining things, we even have people like Elon Musk now says that before he dies, he will put a colony of humans in Mars. So God knows how far we're going to go.
Yes, because your property rights, it's not just land titles. Property right is a lot more when you talk about dead capital.
Yes, that's right. There's a tendency to believe that, well, it's of course, you know, words are, as Lewis Carroll said in Alice in Wonderland, something to the effect about words are what you make them to be. Mm. But in my case, property is not what usually if somebody the English language says, I want a piece of property. They mean actually a piece of land. Mm. To me, property is basically who has the right to control. And there's not one right to control, there's different rights. So for example, most people in the world have the right to own or trade among neighbors or family members. What you Europeans have is a right to own in a variety of ways and abstract ways. You can take a building, which is one solid piece of material, and it belongs to 100 people. So you can divide in the air or in abstract. Mm. And you can then, or you can just say, we're going to divide something in time.
You have said that capitalism will thrive and overcome threats such as terrorism if legal systems change so that most people feel that the law is on their side. I know you've been targeted by terrorists yourself and your organization. Can violence be curbed by legal matters, so
sure.
to say?
Sure it can. First of all, the terrorists didn't target me. I targeted them. I wrote a book called The Other Path, which was a book against the Shining Path. So I thought that they were extremely dangerous. They were killing people. It was a war inside the country that had 70,000 deaths. I saw that it was all about who controlled what. And if we didn't settle that problem, they would win. And I started trying to find out what gave them power, because they only had about maximum 2% of popularity. So we were 98% on the side that wanted change, but not a violent change. These people went off cutting off ears, cutting off heads, cutting off noses. They were very violent. And so I wrote a book called The Other Path on the one hand, and then went into the research and found out that it was all about property.
Also for the terrorists.
For the terrorists, that's right. I mean, well, let's put it this way. The terrorists had two things in motion. At the beginning, they wanted to collectivize everything. They were Maoists. And then when they got in there, they found out that the farmers, in principle, looked collective, because they found out that foreign aid agencies like collective. They found out that everybody likes the idea of collective property, unity, solidarity. This is fine. We are also, I mean, I'm pretty Peruvian solidarity, too. But does my house belong to me or does it belong to somebody else? And they started finding out that it belonged to somebody else. And the farmers resisted. So for 5 years, 3, 4, 5 years, they didn't do too well. Then all of a sudden they said, okay, let's honor the property as it is. Obviously they have parceled out illegally, but they're parceled out. And now we're going to protect their asset. So they titled. And I saw that their strength came through their titling. What the government wasn't able to give them legally, they did at gunpoint. So our plan was, why don't we find a way of doing it through law and cut through lawyers and cut through the whole juridical old Spanish Inca system. Cut, cut, cut. And it was easier to do when you're at war, because if you say that to the military that you're going to win, they will pass the laws. And so that's what we did, basically. And in the process, of course, we were hit. But we were hit because we actually hit them first. Not with bullets, but with a few ideas and with the awarding of rights to the people on the terms that they wanted. We did not go and say, look, this is the way it is in Europe. This is the way it's in Lima. We even create a special organization. What do you want? And they would say things like, well, I want to be able to go away. And my wife can also go away, have another job, and my kids go to school. But I'm afraid that if I do that, my assets will be taken away while I'm away. So the title addressed that. We didn't address in abstract. We addressed in a very pointed way. And we were successful. And the head of the Shining Path did attribute his defeat to us. I mean, he wrote about it. Not everybody else did, but he did. Mm-hmm. Because that's where it was at. So we do know that if a country's conflict is about taking over territory, Islamic State sounds like territory to me. Mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda sounds like territory mm-hmm. to me. FARC sounds like territory to me. I mean, that's what they take. Mm-hmm. So that means that you probably could find a solution there if you talked about property and sovereign rights.
Mm. Also very interesting. Yesterday at the prize ceremony, you spoke about ITC and the digitalization, in which is the essence of our times. And you mentioned that you and ILD in the last years have started to automate the communication process by using social media to reach millions instead of thousands of people. How are you able to use the modern technology in your daily work, so to say? And do you see any disadvantages with using social media?
So far, I only see advantages. First of all, because, of course, I'm surprised by it. I'm not very much into it, so I'm fascinated, of course, like probably technologically overwhelmed. But the fact is that when I communicate, it's about 2,000, 4,000 people at a time. It takes organization. And then all of a sudden, I find out that one message gets to 2.4 million. So undoubtedly, it's great. The other thing is we know how to create reforms using formats, forms. You have to get things organized in forms. And you can do that. Then we found out in the case of Peru that in a population of 30 million inhabitants, which was not true 5 years ago, 17 million have Facebook accounts. And Facebook accounts, even by people who read and write, most Peruvians now read and write, but not so well. When it comes to using digitals, they do it very well. They do it at least a lot better than I do. Mm-hmm. So that's a good way of communicating. And then regarding blockchain, it's just simply the idea of a ledger that is simple to organize at the end from the user's point of view. But I like the idea of multiple, what they call distributed ledgers. And the reason I like it is because the way it is used for, say, Bitcoin mm-hmm. is that everybody gets a ledger, that is to say a screen, that says these are your accounts. That's good. I don't plan to use it that way. My whole redesign is to put the ledgers in the faraway places of the third world so that they see what's happening. You see? The problem that you get when you're, say, a third worlder, and you are resentful that a foreign firm has taken over your oil, Avatar, for example, mm-hmm. or your diamonds, blood diamonds, for example, mm-hmm. or your land, Islamic State, for example, all right? The problem that people who have been left behind by globalization feel is that once that occurs, whatever deal they sign, they all of a sudden see a Western company getting much richer, and they're a little bit better, but not that much richer. So the question is, and then they come back and try and renegotiate all the time. It's complete and total renegotiation. So developed countries feel that contracts are not honored by the third world, and the third world feels that they were very badly paid at the beginning. So what do you expect?
Yes.
But here's the thing. If you title them locally, and the titles are enforced by them, where there's a local consensus, then the words will be honored. If I'm a Peruvian and I'm in the Amazon, and I have agreed to have the oil extracted and I get a benefit, and all of a sudden I say they're not paying me enough, and I'm going to renegotiate or I'm going to stop you, I'm going to block the road, block the river, you're not going to get out anymore, which they do all the time, and somebody comes on and says, you're going to get a very bad name in Stockholm and New York, I don't care. But if it's enforced back home and I don't comply, everybody, my neighbors, will say, it doesn't matter if he's a foreigner, you didn't keep your word. So the idea that I like about blockchain is it spreads accountability. But it doesn't only spread accountability, it also spreads the knowledge of what you're worth. So you're going to negotiate much better at the beginning because your multiple ledgers will tell you that the $10,000 that you're getting for 5 acres should really be $20,000 right from the beginning. Hmm. So what I'm trying to do is look for partners in business. I want profits to go to all the right people, to find ways of turning things like social media, like Facebook, and things like blockchain or Bitcoin around so that they actually help 5 billion people and everybody gets to be quite prosperous, mm-hmm. as opposed to being everybody continue to be poor or unequal. This is interesting, of course, about our times, about globalization. It's not that everybody has not benefited. It's just that some have benefited more than others. And it's quite clear that people care about that. Mm. They do.
Yes. That's a debate we have here in Sweden and in Europe as well. So when it comes to Bitcoin and when it comes to social media and internet, you also have crime, a new kind of crime. Do you see any dangers that this might, when you start working more with ITC, it's that you will get new kind of crimes coming into this? People saying that, oh, I own this land or I own this business, but they don't own it.
Well, the thing is, I think that in the issue of property, in the sense that the ownership of tangible things like land, tractors, homes, factories, anything that's really industrial, it'll be more precise, it'll be a lot better because it'll be recorded in many places. And there are ways to do that. I think that that will get a lot better. Where it might be take time to actually find ways to stop criminality, maybe in abstract things like Bitcoin, where now we have seen that I believe some of the people that have done the hacking have asked to be paid in Bitcoin.
Yes.
So obviously there are, like anything that's new, like an automobile, like locomotives that used to kill cows wherever they pass, it'll take some time before we've learned to get the cows out of the way of the trucks. But you can't stop progress. So I think we'll find our way. These are new technologies. They're not yet regulated. Government has let them come in. They've let Uber come in. They've let blockchain come in. They've let Bitcoin come in. Mm-hmm. It will take time before we even it out.
So a very last question. If you were granted a wish that would be fulfilled within your lifetime, what would that wish be?
You know, I go very much on a day-by-day basis. And I try not, I have goals, but I don't really have wishes, probably because I want to protect myself from disillusion and disappointments. So I would say I like what I do. I feel good if I bring ideas that are new and that they work. And if I can keep on doing that, now, for example, we're talking about automation, scaling up. And to me, what's interesting is I'm trying to figure out what is behind this automation thing. I have found that it obliges you to really get into the nitty-gritty detail of what something is made of because it has to work. I mean, automation, you cannot ask a machine more than yes or no, yes or no. So you have to ask many questions before you get a reply. And just learning that language keeps me happy. So my objective is essentially not to get bored. I think that if I have a nightmare, it's essentially a nightmare of being somewhere that I'm bored. So if as long as I'm not bored, that's my personal stuff. And trying to do good stuff, you know, trying to do good stuff that my mother and my father would have approved of.
Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. De Soto, for coming to Stockholm and being with us here today. I hope you will enjoy the rest of your stay in Sweden. Thank you.
Thank you.